And now the game where we bring on somebody who knows everything and we find out how true that is. It's called Not My Job. Mark Halperin has been a political reporter all his life. These days he does it for Time magazine. But he's also the co-author with John Heilemann of the new book, Game Change. It's all about the backbiting, sex, lying, and anger that was the 2008 presidential campaign. The book reads like a season of Survivor with the winner getting control of a nuclear arsenal. Mark Halperin, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
That's exactly
true. Isn't it true? Am I right? I mean,
that's exactly how we conceived of the book. So.
Really? It's great. Now, it's a little bit like that because you start off with this cast of motley characters, all the candidates, and one by one they drop out, backbiting and vicious infighting, and the last guy left gets to be president.
That is pretty much the way the founders envisioned the process working.
Yes. Now, there is so much gossip in the book, and we're appalled, which is why we're going to talk to you about it at length. But how do you react to the criticisms we've heard from some quarters that this is just too gossipy, not substantive enough, and why are we indulging in all this muck?
Well, I don't think of it as muck and gossip, actually. I think of it as the real story of what happened in this campaign. It was the story behind the story of the candidates and in many instances, their spouses, the stories of their lives were intersected with what we saw in the public realm. So we included only things that we thought were deeply woven into the fabric of the narrative and of the personalities.
Right. So
And the fact that a bunch of idiocy happened to be deeply woven into the narrative was bonus, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, not just bonus, but why we thought we could write the book. Because these were not, this was not Dick Lugar and John Kerry and Lamar Alexander. These were not just interesting people, but famous people, more just as likely to be on People magazine or Oprah.
Right.
As they were to be on Time or Newsweek.
I'm sorry, did you just use John Kerry as an example of an interesting person?
No, just the opposite.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The clue was I grouped him with Dick Lugar and Lamar
Alexander. Right, right. I was puzzled.
You don't know about Peter's charter membership of the Dick Lugar fan club.
You and your co-author, obviously, like every political journalist, was covering the election. Did you know all this stuff while it was happening and we're sitting around going, I can't wait till it's all over and we can publish this stuff?
Any of it. We would sit in these interviews, which we did some during the campaign year, but most immediately after the election. And we were at once exhilarated for learning all this new stuff and feeling like knuckleheads, like we were covering the campaign with bags over our heads because we thought we were paying pretty close attention, and we missed almost everything that's in the book.
Wow, really?
Wow. Hey, Mark, can I ask you a question?
Okay.
Okay, so I'm an advice columnist, and I haven't read your book yet or seen the Lifetime movie of it. So can you give me, what's the juiciest spouse stuff?
Don't spoil the ending, Mark.
What's the juiciest, spousal stuff you got?
Well, there's one scene where one candidate is angry at the spouse and engages in an 11-word sentence. 10 of the words are the same word, and it begins with the letter F.
And that story, I should just say, for those who haven't read the book, was about John McCain.
It's incredible the amount of fighting that the McCains and John and Elizabeth Edwards would do in front of the staff. And these poor staffers are trying to, think about high principles, and instead they're turning their heads away while the principals are having these incredibly roiling fights with profanity laced and often leaving them late for the next event.
So there's been a lot of discussion in the media about your sourcing, and you've said everything was in deep background, so you're not going to tell us who told you what. But my question for you is, when you were being told a story like the one you just told us about the McCains fighting viciously in front of the aides, how could you know that it's truth or that at least it's unbiased when obviously somebody's telling tales out of school and they know they won't get caught?
Sure. Totally fair question. The answer is, in brief, we did over 300 interviews for the book with over 200 people. The interviews were long, some 6 or 7 hours long, almost all over an hour. These are people we've known in some cases for literally 20 years, and they trusted us. They were invested in the
project. Foolish them. But go on.
They were invested in the project. They thought we were writing a serious history. But there were other reasons that maybe were a little bit less noble. There was one person we really wanted to interview for the book. It was one of the few important interviews with someone who neither John Heilemann nor I knew, and so it was a stranger, and we emailed and called them, and no reply. And then before we finished the book, we signed a deal with HBO. We optioned the movie rights to them, and that appeared in the newspaper. And the next day at 7 a.m., this person called John Heilman and said, "Hey, HBO movie, sign me up. When do I do my interview?"
Wow. So, and was it valuable? And did they give you dirt? Was it worth waiting for?
Oh, totally and completely.
Oh. Sarah Palin, we got to talk about that. We made fun of her. A lot of people made fun of her during the campaign. Did you get a bum rap? Were we being fair to her?
Well, there's a lot of sides of her that were not revealed publicly and were quite a shock to me and John. We thought the main concern that the campaign had was about her, what we might call euphemistically, her narrow bandwidth.
Yeah. Okay, go on.
No, she's a human 28K modem.
Well, look, as we point out in the book, you know, there's a reason to have sympathy for her. McCain really did her a disservice by picking her at the last minute. Without warning to her, without any preparation on the part of the campaign staff. And if you think about it, this is a woman with a lot of responsibilities before her, and the campaign didn't do very much to prepare her for that.
You are certainly nonpartisan in the dirt that you dish. Everybody has some stories about themselves that maybe they wish hadn't been told. But the one person who comes out of the book smelling pretty good is Barack Obama. And you have been accused of, what is the word, kissing up? No, that's not it. But something like that. The idea is like, oh, you know, you're being nice to the president because he's still important. These other guys are now has-beens. But you held your punches with Barack Obama. Is that true?
Well, I think if people read all of Game Change, they'll see that this is a book about primarily not a political book in the sense of it's not about polls and tactics and strategy. It's about the candidates and their spouses. And when people read the book and they see the level of dysfunction, you know that you got a lot of marital dysfunction when the Clintons have, like, the fourth most dysfunctional marriage of people in the book.
Woo!
Yeah.
John and Elizabeth Edwards and Rudy Giuliani and Judith Giuliani. You know, I think the McCains would give the Clintons a run for their money, too. The Obamas, by contrast, had a very stable marriage, as far as our reporting showed. And Obama himself, an extraordinarily cool guy in the sense of never too high, never too low, served him very well in the campaign. And when that's the focus, a guy who's a pretty normal guy comes off pretty well.
Before we move on to the game, I wanted to get, as your professional political analyst, your opinion about politics today. Let's take the Democratic Party.
Sure.
Are they more, in your opinion, like jellyfish or sea slugs?
Can I go with sea monkeys?
Well, Mark Halperin, it's a pleasure to have you. We have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
You are the one and only, and we do mean only, Prince of Saborga.
So you think our politicians are colorful and eccentric? Then you never met Giorgio Carbone, Prince of Saborga. He died in November. He spent his life trying to convince the world that his little village of Saborga in Italy near the French border was an independent kingdom. In 1995, he got the 300 or so residents there to vote him into the office of Prince. So we're going to ask you three questions about Prince Signor Carbone of Saborga and his little principality. Get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners. Ready to play?
Am I supposed to be wearing the blindfold now or not?
No. Nor are you supposed to go into the isolation booth.
All right, blindfold off, isolation booth door left ajar.
You're right. Carl, who
is... Why do we even have that isolation booth?
I don't know. We can't see him. It's such a pain to ship it to his apartment.
And we let him keep the door open. I mean, it's just
I live in a doorman building, so it's delivered with no problem.
Carl, who is Mark Halperin playing for?
Mark is playing for Melanie Carrick of Asheville, North Carolina.
All right. Ready to play?
I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
First question. Once he became Prince of Saborga, Giorgio Carbone issued stamps and created a currency, but he didn't actually do much ruling. He did pass a law once to do what? A, make the ham and cheese sandwich the official sandwich of Saborga. B, encourage people in Saborga to smoke. Or C, declare war on Antarctica.
They're so obviously all made up, and thus, by the rule of how I... able to ace my SATs, I'll go with B.
You're going to go with B. Encourage people to smoke. You're correct. Wow, you must have done well in your SATs.
I only got the questions right where the answer was B.
There you are. He was a heavy smoker himself, presumably, and didn't want to stand out on the sidewalk by himself. All right, next question. Prince Giorgio, during his reign, took the safety of Saborgans very seriously. How did he set out to defend his people? A, he established an army which consisted of one guy. B, he handed out slingshots to all 300 residents to be used in case of an invasion. Or C, he assigned the houses random numbers so outsiders could not find their way around.
As my niece would say, it's so A.
It's so A?
Yeah.
The one guy army?
Hmm?
You're right.
Whoa.
It's like he took the whole army of one thing. He was a lieutenant, though. The guy got to be an officer, so that was exciting for him. All right, well, I'm going to see if you can go perfect here. Let's see how accurate you are. The prince had another title. You were supposed to address him when you saw him around Seborga as what? A, O great leader of tininess. B, the worshipful hero of Seborga. Or C, his tremendousness.
Can I do it in the original language?
Yes, you can.
No, I'm saying, like, I feel like...
Oh, I thought you knew it. I don't know.
Those are translations.
No,
does anyone ever ask for the question to be repeated? All right, I'm going with B, my final answer.
B is B? Your answer is B?
Yeah.
Worshipful hero of Seborga? No, he was known as His Tremendousness. His Tremendousness, the Prince of Seborga.
Yeah.
Carl, how did Mark Halperin do in our quiz?
Mark had two correct answers, Peter, and that was good enough to win for Melanie Carrick. Congratulations.
Good work.
Mark Halperin is a senior political analyst for Time Magazine and the co-author, along with John Heilemann, of the new book, Game Change, which I recommend. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Honored to be on. Appreciate
Great to have you. Great to talk to you. Take care.